This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Barry Broom recently left the Greater Phoenix Economic Council for Sacramento. GPEC has been an economic development group focused on bringing jobs to the Valley. But one out-of-town observer, former Arizona Republic columnist John Talton, says the city of Phoenix should be focused on its own economic development. I'll talk with Talton and City of Phoenix Community and Economic Development Director Christine McKay. Plus, National Review editor Rich Lowry will be in Tempe tomorrow to help open a new school at ASU. His focus will be on Abraham Lincoln. I'll talk with Lowry about Lincoln's leadership and whether it'd be possible in today's hyper-partisan culture. We start today's program with a closer look at Governor Doug Ducey's first budget proposal. With the state staring at another significant shortfall, the governor decided that cutting millions from the state's public universities was one path to take. With me to talk about that is Eileen Klein, president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Eileen, good morning.
Good morning.
Did you expect state university funding to be a target in the governor's proposed budget?
Absolutely. So we certainly recognize with the fiscal struggles that are still ongoing with the state that universities, being one of the largest still unprotected sources in the general fund, would be a target. And while universities certainly recognize the need to, you know, do their part to help solve the budget challenges, ultimately we are concerned about the direction and the reversal of course, really, that we've seen from the past couple of years where we were able to add monies back to the universities, monies that were much needed.
As a former chief of staff, former budget director, you know all about budget problems, but does this indicate to you anything about what the governor thinks about what the state universities contribute to our economy and the overall aspect of the state?
Not at all. Governor Ducey certainly supports public higher education. There's no doubt about that. The question really for all of us going forward is, how are we going to create a sustainable model for our public universities? They're constitutional entities, and they're more important than ever to individuals' ability to succeed in this economy and to our state's ability to succeed and be competitive. So we really need to work with our policymakers so that any of these reductions are short-term in nature and that we really work to revamp our model and understand going forward how we're going to make sure that our universities remain affordable for families.
Who puts together that model? How many stakeholders have to be at the table to talk about that?
So we have started the conversation among regents and the university presidents, and we have proposed a couple of variations on state funding to policymakers over the course of the past couple of years. You recall that universities used to be funded based on inputs or the number of students who showed up at our doorstep, and that model doesn't work. We really want to reposition our system so that we get funded by the state based on achievements we make that are relative to the Arizona economy, how many graduates we produce, how many STEM graduates in particular, and also how much our research is contributing to economic growth. Those are important things to be considered for state funding going forward, along with strategic capital infrastructure. So we recognize that the state can't afford to participate the way that it used to, but absolutely we have to stop the direct cost shift that is going on right now, where as state general fund reductions are made, families are asked to pick up the tab and pick up the difference. Families and tuition simply can't be the backstop for the state's fiscal challenges.
And ASU President Crow has said he will not look for another tuition increase. In the short term, though, is that difficult?
So in the short term, certainly that works. And he was speaking about in-state students. And I will say that all three of our university presidents have made a commitment to minimize the impacts on students and their costs and the services to students. But again, this is a question about what happens from here. You know, we're eager to see the state recover. We believe we play a very important role in all of that. But ultimately, we just need to advance a model so that we know we have predictable funding coming from the state that we can count on and that families can count on so that we can keep prices down.
When it comes to making what I would consider, based on what you're saying, a fairly big policy shift, is this one of those things where no one wants to be patient, but will there have to be because this is going to be a complex change?
Well, certainly we'll work with the university presidents very closely to get through this round of reductions, whatever level they turn out to be. And again, we'll try to minimize the impacts on students, but we're eager, very eager to start the conversation with policymakers about how we turn the corner and really create a plan that works for the long term for Arizona.
Eileen, is this one of those things, too, where you have to get people to have a basic understanding as opposed to before you can jump into something bigger? I know just a couple of years ago, I think if I'm right, there was a discussion of having, you know, new research facilities built as an example of the impact on the economy that universities can have based on research, based on technology transfer, that kind of thing, bringing products to market. is it hard to make that leap if you don't have everyone sort of believing on the same page with the basic aspects and the importance of the university system?
So that certainly is a challenge. I think overall people recognize the importance of a college degree, but we need to translate that into how we can build public support and public contributions to the system itself and to the students. And that's the part where we still need to do some work. And we want to build the case. We can make a very strong case about why universities are important to individuals and to the state's economy. But ultimately, we need policymakers to value it enough that they're willing to make those expenditures on behalf of public higher education in Arizona. It's really going to be essential for the long-term success of Arizona.
And do you believe there has to be a grassroots effort to accompany what's going on with the Board of Regents, what you're talking to policymakers, in the sense that we have, I mean, how many tens of thousands of people in this state have either graduated from ASU, U of A, or NAU?
Yes, and we do have strong support. We're glad for that. But you know, they also recognize the state's going through some short-term challenges. We certainly ask for their patience as we work to this place with a new model. But it is important that people express to policymakers that higher education matters. It can't just matter while you're in school. It has to matter after you're out of school so that other people have that same opportunity. It benefits all of us.
And finally, you're someone who, through your time as chief of staff and budget director, you were known as someone who handled things in a very classy way, an intelligent way. When you look at something like this, does it test your patience? Is it tough to get in there and want to do that in a way that doesn't repel people?
Well, thanks. Thanks very much for that. And I do think we have great opportunities to partner with our new governor, with his team, and with our newly elected legislature. I think they are eager for reform. I don't have a sense that there's a majority of people who want to cut just for cut's sake. I do think they want to reform. But again, we need to sit down and help develop that new path.
Eileen Klein is president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Thanks as always.
Great. Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. As we just talked about, Governor Doug Ducey is calling for millions of dollars in cuts to Arizona's public universities in his proposed budget. Many states made cuts to higher education during the Great Recession, but are other states still proposing those cuts? With me for a few minutes to talk about that is James Palmer, professor at Illinois State University. He's the editor of Grapevine, an online compilation of state fiscal support for higher education. Professor Palmer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, so what sort of trends have you seen over the past few years? Are most states funding colleges and universities at a higher level than they were during the recession?
Well, it's a mixed bag right now. When we take a look at fiscal 15, that is 2014-2015, 25 states are funding higher education at levels that are lower than funding 5 years ago in fiscal 2010. So you got about half of the states have recovered from the recession and half haven't.
So those that are increasing or have increased, is that increase growing at a greater rate in 2014-2015 as opposed to 2013-2014, or is there inconsistency there?
Well, it's the overall national increase this year, take a look at all 50 states, was 5.2%. Now, the year before, taking a look at from fiscal 13 to fiscal 14, we had an increase of about 6.1%. So the increase this year is a little less than what we experienced last year. It is a mixed bag. Much depends on the economies of the states and of course, politics. And, of course, the recession affected state economies differently.
What states stand out to you in terms of those that are more aggressively increasing funding and those that haven't increased as rapidly? Is there some sort of pattern you're seeing?
Well, it's hard to say. California, in the past 2 years, has increased funding quite significantly. I think that's probably the result of the leadership of Governor Jerry Brown. There was, I believe, also a tax increase in California. So California has increased funding for higher education. Florida has increased funding for higher education over the past 2 years. And in fact, the most of the national increase that we saw for fiscal 15 was accounted for by three states, Florida, California, and Illinois. And if you factor out those three states, the national increase, instead of being 5.2%, is really only 2.9%. I should note that Illinois' fairly large increase is a function of its problems with its state pension funds. Practically all of the increases to higher education funding in Illinois have been targeted to the state university retirement system to shore up a badly underfunded pension fund.
I know you make a point with Grapevine to not necessarily parse the numbers too closely or look for certain patterns, but I did want to ask you one question. When you think about some of the states that you mentioned that are putting more into it, those are some of the higher populated states. Is there anything that we're seeing in terms of red versus blue? Are there states that lean one way politically that have funded more or less based on what you've seen?
No, not really. I think you can see a mixed pattern there. Much depends on the history of funding over the past 6 or 7 years. You know, historically, what seems to have happened, when there are decreases in state funding after a recession, there comes a point when policymakers often say, well, we need to make up what has been lost. And that mentality, I think, has prevailed in most states, red state or blue state. But you raise a good point here. You know, when we take a look at our data and we have, you know, 50 states, we have 50 background stories here. And it's very hard to make generalizations about what's going on.
Finally, James, based on the numbers you see, how individualized is each state's fiscal situation? Because I think there's the Great Recession affected every state. So I think people look very closely at the broader U.S. economy. But based on what you're seeing, do we really have to look state by state to realize what's going on there? And is it harder to make, well, as you said, 25 states doing this, 25 states doing that.
Yeah.
How much of a challenge is that when you look at the numbers?
It's very challenging because, as I said, each state has a different history in higher education and a different set of economic circumstances. For example, as we approach the next fiscal year, energy-producing states, Louisiana, Alaska, Texas, for example, may find that they are less able to increase funding for higher education because of drops in the oil prices, which in fact ultimately reduces tax revenues in those states. So those states will be facing circumstances that other states won't be.
James Palmer is a professor at Illinois State University. He's the editor of Grapevine, an online compilation of state fiscal support for higher education. If you're interested, you can find it online. All sorts of interesting charts and numbers. Professor, thanks for the time.
You're very welcome.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at economic development in the Valley. Should Phoenix be going out on its own? We'll also talk with Rich Lowry of National Review. He's in the Valley to talk about Abraham Lincoln. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center, creating customized plans with cancer treatment options for all cancer types. Information at BannerMDAnderson.com. We are all in for the fight against cancer.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Taking a look at some current temperatures around Arizona right now, sunny skies and 63 degrees in Tucson. It's partly sunny and 43 in Prescott, sunny and 63 in Casa Grande, cloudy skies and 34 degrees in Flagstaff, 72 degrees under fair skies in Yuma. Checking Valley traffic right now on the US 60, the Superstition Freeway westbound. There's a crash blocking the shoulder at Alma School Road. Are you planning to buy a new car this year? Before you trade or sell your current vehicle, consider donating it to support the programs you love here on KJZZ. We'll take it away for free and you get a tax deduction. To donate, go to cars.kjzz.org and thanks. Right now in the Valley with 41% relative humidity, we have partly cloudy skies and 64 degrees at 1121.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Abraham Lincoln is widely considered to be one of the best, if not the best, president in U.S. history. And Lincoln's story from many angles and parts of his life is one of the favorites of historians and novelists alike. Rich Lowry, National Review editor, wrote about the 16th president in his book, Lincoln Unbound. Lowry will be in the Valley tomorrow as he helps mark the opening of ASU's new Center for Political Thought and Leadership. And he joins me now. Rich, you're the author of Lincoln Unbound. In the broadest sense, what do you admire most about Abraham Lincoln?
I admire Lincoln as an aspirational figure, and I think that's his most important and enduring lesson for this country, that when it's working as it should, a talented guy living in the middle of nowhere with no, what you would think, no prospects, can with some pluck and a lot of hard work make the most of himself. And that's what Lincoln did himself, and that's the kind of America that he sought to develop and open up to all sorts of other people.
Yeah, we always talk about how much the world has changed, how much the U.S. has changed in all those years. So what are some things that still remain, though? Because there are many people who would say, well, it would be nice to have someone like Lincoln, but before he got to that stage, something would occur, there'd be some TV show that would say something bad about him, and then he'd drop out.
Well, I think really politics is more similar than we think. We think our politics is somehow uniquely poisonous and combative, and you look at the 19th century, even before the Civil War, where things are directly to the run-up to the Civil War, when things really reached a boiling point. And it was a rough and tumble business. One of Lincoln's advantages as a politician was that he was such a big guy in case there was a tussle. You know, Stephen Douglas bit and scarred for life the thumb of a newspaper editor who wrote something that offended him. Lincoln would write these vicious anonymous attacks on Democrats in Illinois, and when he was discovered by one of these Democratic officials, he was challenged to a duel and almost fought a duel. He won scrape in a legislative battle over whether there was going to be a quorum for a vote on the State Bank of Illinois, which Lincoln was very supportive of. Lincoln jumped out of a window of the state legislature. So these are things that have always been with us. American politics has always been contentious, and I think we're a little bit wrong-footed by the glory years immediately after World War II, when there was a kind of political consensus in this country that's really been really rare throughout our history.
Rich, what about the system then in a more general sense? Because I do wonder, based on what people like to say, is it possible to really admire political figures today, considering how inept a lot of people think the entire system is right now?
I would say that's always been an aspect of our system. It was really designed to make it hard to pass laws and to get things done. And we look at Lincoln now, understandably, back with kind of a haze of glory around him. That's not the way people viewed him at the time. And he was a figure of great mockery and ridicule and hatred, even when he was president. And when he was running for re-election in 1864, for a long period of time, he didn't think he was going to win. There was a famous meeting he had with Frederick Douglass in the White House, saying, look, I think I could lose, and if I lose, the Emancipation Proclamation is going to be repealed, so I need to have you use whatever agents you can to spread the word in the South so as many slaves can escape and get to the North before the Emancipation Proclamation is rolled back. And it was only with the victory in the war and the assassination quickly on the heels of it that Lincoln became a universally beloved figure.
What do you think the clearest and cleanest lessons we as a society, and maybe more specifically elected officials, can learn from what Lincoln was able to accomplish, even with all those obstacles you bring up?
Well, there are a couple things. One, the true north for any American politician, I believe, has to be opportunity and equality of opportunity and the opportunity to rise in our society. Now, we can have all sorts of policy arguments back and forth between the left and the right about how best to achieve it, but that should be the goal we're all aiming for, and it's the one that motivated Lincoln throughout his adult life and his political career. And then Lincoln really has an important lesson for all statesmen, which is you set out the fixed goal, and for him it was ending slavery and making this an even greater country of opportunity. And then you're very situational about how you achieve it. And this is something that the movie Lincoln, which I thought was quite inspired, captured brilliantly. Because there's some people who interpreted that, oh, this is a movie that's a metaphor about political compromise, and a compromise is how you get things done in Washington. Well, not really. You know, this was Lincoln jamming through an amendment to end slavery because he thought it was right as a matter of principle, Now, once he'd set out that goal and that principle, well, then, you know, you twist some arms, you make some compromises, you may decide this isn't the right time for it, we need to wait a little while longer. And, in fact, Lincoln was hated by the radicals within his own party and Congress, who always thought he was too slow. But he was always just, you know, about 13 months behind where they were, because he had a very keen sense of what was possible. And if you push things too soon and you lose everything, well, then you've set back your goal. So how is that more principled than being the prudential statesman who practices the art of the possible? So every politician needs to try to make that balance, and some of them are better at it than others, but truly inspired statesmen like Lincoln get the balance right.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Rich Lowry, the National Review editor. He'll be in the Valley on Thursday as he helps mark the opening of ASU's new Center for Political Thought and Leadership. Rich, one more question about Lincoln. Can both major political parties now claim a connection with him, an admiration for him, and not have it seem sort of patronizing, that predictable behavior, sort of like when candidates from across the spectrum claim that they have a kinship with Ronald Reagan, for example?
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you become truly an honored figure in American history. Lincoln belongs to all of us, and the Whigs and the Republicans of Lincoln's time don't really fit our contemporary political categories very precisely, because he believed more, I would argue, in individual responsibility and kind of a cultural conservatism and cohesiveness than a lot of people on the left do today. But he was in favor of a much more activist government than a lot of conservatives today are comfortable with. So he doesn't fit easily into any pegs, but I consider him part of the, you know, I've mentioned the true north being opportunity in this country. Well, Lincoln is kind of the symbol of that true north, so I think it's a healthy thing if all of us are trying to claim a piece of him.
And finally, we're only about a year or so away from Iowa, New Hampshire. Who are you watching on the Republican side as far as the presidential race, and anyone interesting to you on the Democratic side that you're watching closely?
Well, the Republican race is fascinating. It's already been fascinating. I never would have expected Jeb Bush to get in, actually. I thought all these statements he made about how he needed to examine himself and his motivations and see if he was really up for it, that's usually a pretty good sign that someone's not up for it, but he appears to be throwing his hat into the ring, and I'm completely shocked that Mitt Romney seems to be on the verge of doing the same. And I think this is the way the Republican race is going to go. It's going to have a lot of surprises. It's going to be very hard to make firm and fast predictions. The one thing I would say I'm disappointed by is that for Republicans, it seems this should really be a turn-the-page election. And so far, the people who have been making the most serious moves, or at least making the loudest noises, are Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush, and Mike Huckabee. And none of these folks are fresh faces. On the Democratic side, there's this bizarre mismatch between the strength of Hillary Clinton, who is as close to being an incumbent president running for renomination as as anyone who's not an incumbent president has ever been. The mismatch between her strength and how she's really kind of out of step with the new populist spirit in the Democratic Party, certainly among the grassroots represented by Elizabeth Warren. So in that space between those two things, there is a lot of room for someone to make a lot of mischief, and I don't know who for her, and I don't know who it is or how it's exactly going to play out, but I doubt she's going to get the waltz that it looks like she's going to get, and someone is going to fill that populist space.
Rich Lowry is the editor of National Review. He'll help open ASU's new Center for Political Thought and Leadership Thursday night at 6:30 on Tempe campus. He'll be talking about Abraham Lincoln and the American idea. Rich, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The legislative and judicial branches in Arizona don't seem to have the most cordial of relations, and a new proposal by a couple of Republican state lawmakers probably won't help things. The proposed legislation would require judges up for retention to get 60% of votes cast instead of the current simple majority. With me for a few minutes to explain is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dean of the Capital Press Corps. Howie, good morning.
Good morning.
Howie, who's pushing this and why?
Well, you've actually got two proposals. The one you mentioned is by Representative Phil Lovas. Right now, in the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and the Superior Courts of Maricopa, Pima, and Pinal counties, judges are selected through what they call a merit selection process. You go through a screening committee. They make recommendations to the governor. The governor has to choose from the list. And then these people stand for retention or rejection on a regular basis. So you don't run against anybody, unlike in the other 12 counties. Right now, a simple 50% on retention will get you back for another 4 years for Superior Court, 6 years for the Supreme Court. What Representative Lovis is saying is that given you're not running against anyone, you should have to get at least 60% to prove that you are, in fact, liked by the people and you're doing what people want. And had that been the case, there are several judges who were just reelected this past year who would not have made it. And so he wants to raise the bar. The more interesting one in some ways is by Representative Warren Peterson. He wants to say that if with the two-thirds vote of the House and Senate, they can remove any judge at all just for no reason. Now, you're probably saying, well, wait, isn't there an impeachment process? Well, there is, and that's in the Arizona Constitution. You know, high crimes, misdemeanors, malfeasance in office. But his contention is that judges are, in his words, going rogue. They're going ahead and making laws and interpreting the Constitution, and the only way that you're going to bring them back into control is if two-thirds of the legislature can remove them. Now, this gets into some fascinating questions, obviously, about checks and balances if the legislature can essentially overrule the judiciary, and I think that's where the big discussion is going to be.
You talked with a lobbyist for the Arizona Judges Association. Did he react to both of the proposed pieces of legislation?
Oh, yes. They've been fighting changes to merit selection since it was first adopted in 1974 by voters. For example, 2 years ago, there was a measure on the ballot to say, it was 3 years ago, I guess now, that the selection commission would have to send the governor at least 8 names rather than just a minimum of 3 to give the governor more choices and perhaps to name a political favorite. And the voters defeated that. And yet the folks who want to tinker with the process seem to keep coming back. And he said, what's wrong with it? What exactly is not working? Well, what usually happens is there's a court case that somehow lawmakers don't like the fact that the courts have decided that what they did is illegal. Case in point, school finance. Mm-hmm. The voters told the legislature in 2000, you will fund inflation. The legislature said, no, we don't have to, and we can interpret the law to say we could just fund a portion of the inflation. And the court acknowledged maybe that's the way the law was written, but they sold it to voters by saying we're going to fund full inflation. They directed the Secretary of State to tell voters we're going to fund full inflation. And to come back now would be breaking the law, which is why we have this question of $330 million maybe going to schools immediately, $1 billion in back aid. Well, the lawmakers, having lost the case, figure, well, we'll show them. We'll just get rid of the judges.
Howie, you mentioned the word rogue. We always hear the term activist judges. We hear this on both sides. Does anyone really know what that means when they say it?
Well, let's see. If you didn't decide it my way, you went rogue. I think I figured that one out. Well, there's an ongoing issue in the courts. You know, is a strict interpretation of the Constitution and the statutes versus a living Constitution. Does freedom of the press also cover radio? I mean, I'm guessing that Thomas Jefferson wasn't considering K-Jazz when he wrote the thing. So you've got questions of what was the intent of the framers of the Constitution? Or in the case of, let's say, school finance, what was the intent of voters when they said, look, we are willing to raise our sales taxes by 0.6% if you fund inflation? And so is it the job of the courts to look at what voters wanted when they passed that? A lot of people would say yes. A lot of people would say no. You stick to the black letter of the law, and if they screwed up on the wording, you have to stick to that. It's an interesting philosophical question that continues to go on, you know, a couple of centuries into the country.
And Howie, I'll continue that in the last minute or so on this same philosophical track, just because it keeps coming back to this for me. You've covered the Capitol for decades, and it seems like every legislative session lawmakers are picking fights with the judicial branch. And it seems like the state Supreme Court at this point is, by, I would say, all accounts, pretty much down the middle, sort of that moderate sort of court. So what do you think they really want?
Well, I think that they want something that honors the will of the legislature, that the legislature said it, so therefore it must be true. You know, what's fascinating is, look at the school finance case, look at the Medicaid case. Three of the justices of the Supreme Court were appointed by Governor Jan Brewer. These are hardly, you know, radical activists. And yet, and if the lawmakers don't get their way, if some lawmakers don't get their way, they're convinced that the courts must have done it wrong. So it depends. Now, the lawmakers got their way, curiously enough, on the Medicaid expansion lawsuit, and now you had then Governor Jan Brewer saying, oh, it's an activist court misinterpreting what the law says. So whoever loses, to get back to your original question, whoever loses, it's an activist court, they're rogue.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services, he's dean of the Capital Press Corps. Howie, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about whether Phoenix should separate itself from the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. Plus, what's the secret to ASU's women's basketball team being on such a roll? We'll talk about all of that coming up.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Symphony, performing with George Benson at the Mesa Arts Center on January 21st. This one-night-only performance will include original hits, Breezin', On Broadway, and more. MesaArtsCenter.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. We should see partly sunny skies this afternoon in the valley. Still a very slight chance for some rain, and the high is expected to reach 71 degrees. Partly sunny tomorrow, a little bit cooler, the high just 66, and 67 on Thursday. Stay with us at 12 o'clock on KJZZ for Here and Now from Boston. We'll hear what's next for the President and Congress after the State of the Union. And a visit to the Paris neighborhood that was home to one of the shooters in the terrorist attacks on that city. NPR's Here and Now comes your way at noon. Partly cloudy skies and 64 degrees in the valley at 11:38.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Greater Phoenix Economic Council was formed a couple of decades ago with at least the partial goal of diversifying the area's economy, bringing in attractive jobs from other places. GPEC's most recent president, Barry Broom, left just a few weeks ago for a similar position in Sacramento. So how important is GPEC, specifically to not Greater Phoenix or the Valley, but Phoenix itself? Former Arizona Republic columnist John Talton writes about the economy for the Seattle Times and writes a lot about Arizona at roguecolumnist.com. In one of his recent columns, Talton argued for Phoenix to separate itself from GPEC. John, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
It's not a new argument for you. You've said it before, but what do you think the best arguments are for Phoenix to be in the economic development game on its own?
When GPEC was formed, Phoenix was by far the dominant center of the metropolitan area. It was where all the big companies were, and the big companies supported the original president of GPEC, Ioana Morfesis, and GPEC was able to get things done. Now the metropolitan area has gotten so big, and the very large suburbs are competing against each other, competing against Phoenix, and they have different needs. Phoenix has a very large, older area that GPEC generally does not serve. To the extent GPEC does bring in economic development, it does so for the fringes, for spec new construction. Phoenix just has different needs now, and it needs a more extensive economic development toolkit. I will say that some starts are being made at City Hall, but I don't know that GPEC is going to do it for Phoenix in the city anymore.
Has being in GPEC hurt Phoenix's ability to really be a leader in the region?
Well, the view of Mayor Stanton, and I think the dominant view at City Hall, is that Phoenix has to play nice with the metropolitan area, both because it is the big city and the suburbs lean on Phoenix for a number of things, including running the bus system and talent from City Hall to go help them. But also the fear that the legislature will slam down on the city even harder if for some reason it's not playing well with the suburbs. But look, let's face it, there's already a blood sport among every city in the valley for sales tax dollars. And it's not just the suburbs against Phoenix, it's suburb against suburb. But Phoenix has very unique needs, and it has a need to really elevate its economy.
John, when jobs go to Mesa or Chandler, for example, is that more than just looking bad as far as perception is concerned, or does it really seem to hurt Phoenix?
Well, the overall problem is that we're not really growing the pie. We're just kind of moving pieces of the pie. So Midtown Phoenix used to be a vibrant business center. Downtown Phoenix, a vibrant business center. This is just not the case anymore. It's a lot better than it was 5 years ago, but it's certainly not where it was when GPEC was founded. And so when we have the Price Corridor, when we have even 24th Street and Camelback within the city, these are not necessarily net new assets. And if they are, they're not making up the losses soon enough. And so what you've got to have is a very urban-focused economic development outfit.
Is the heart of Phoenix given enough attention? We hear about downtown a lot, but is it in a good position right now based on infrastructure and other things to be able to attract the kinds of higher-paying jobs, the kind of high-tech jobs? We've seen it a little bit when it comes to the biomedical corridor near the U of A Medical School. But are there other spots you're thinking of other than, as you mentioned, the inevitable 24th Street and Camelback?
Well, we have the entire Central Corridor that is playing at, like, second gear. And that goes from downtown, which is doing much better with Cityscape and places like that, the ASU campus, the Phoenix Biomedical Campus, and then on up into Midtown, where we have these zombie skyscrapers that once had banks in them, but now those banks have been bought or moved or closed or whatever. And so there's way too much land and not enough economic activity. But when you compare Central Phoenix to the central part of virtually any major city that is comparing it against, we don't have enough private sector investment. We don't have enough large headquarters. We don't have enough civic stewards who are really involved. Call centers ain't going to do it.
Earlier in this program, we talked about Governor Doug Ducey's proposed cuts to the state university system. How much do you think that hurts when it comes to economic development, if in fact the cuts go forward and the universities are pulling back instead of pushing ahead?
It's very misguided because we are in a competition for talent and capital that can go anywhere. Now, university funding all around the country is facing various degrees of difficulty. And President Crow has been very imaginative at ASU in finding ways to bring in new money. That said, there's only so many times you can push the boulder up the hill. Arizona's putting itself at a tremendous disadvantage in both attracting and retaining talent by cutting university funding.
John Talton is economy columnist for the Seattle Times. He also writes about Arizona frequently at roguecolumnist.com. He's also a mystery writer with the David Mapstone Mysteries. John, thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last summer, Phoenix hired Christine McKay to be its new Director of Community and Economic Development. She'd previously worked for the City of Chandler, and she fits us in for a few minutes in her busy schedule. Christine, good morning.
Good morning.
So can Phoenix be a regional leader while also focusing on drawing attractive jobs for itself when it's a member of GPEC, for example?
You know, I think with the city of Phoenix being the sixth largest city in the country, I think it is the regional leader. I jokingly laugh at the city managers that this is the 800-pound gorilla of the region. The way Phoenix goes is the way the rest of the region moves along with it. And I think being the largest city as a member of GPEC provides a tremendous alliance between the city and the region and GPEC.
There are some, and John Talton, who's just on, would argue this, that Phoenix needs to be more selfish in such a competitive environment that almost, I'm going to put words in people's mouths, but almost this idea of having coattails, where Phoenix being the leader should be good for Chandler, for Mesa, for Tempe, but it needs to be Phoenix first. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm highly competitive, so I would agree with you. It needs to be Phoenix first. But I think what is even a bigger picture of that is we can't ever forget to be competitive for the city that we work for. That's who citizens were looking for jobs. But I think what's more important is the fact that the citizens and the jobs that we attract and retain don't necessarily live in the city of Phoenix. So what's good for the city of Phoenix, you're right, is good for Chandler, is good for Tempe, is good for Goodyear, because there's that cross-relational partnership. The citizens may live live in Goodyear and work in Phoenix, and conversely, a citizen may live in Phoenix and work in Chandler. And I think that's one of the reasons, as I was listening to Mr. Talton earlier, what the other regions do so well is because they do take a regional approach. They do focus on, it comes from the governor's office to the regional office and the state office to the city, the county, the school districts. They all work collaboratively together, part and parcel with their universities. And when they're looking at attracting those corporate headquarters and those mega companies into a region, they work very collaboratively together. Cities really are the only people who know where our boundaries are.
Kristen, what have you noticed in the time you've been in Phoenix, based on the positives, also negatives or challenges, based on being in Phoenix versus Chandler?
You bet. Well, this is a very big city. I was used to 71 square miles. I could tell you where every fire hydrant was. And this is now a 517 square mile city. It is basically like having 14 or 15 villages within one city, incredibly diverse. So on the positive side, when you're looking at an attractions model, when you're looking at working with your existing companies, it's across the board. It's from high tech and manufacturing, advanced business services, a strong entrepreneurship play, the biosciences corridor here in downtown Phoenix, and conversely up along Mayo Boulevard, the higher education and healthcare that we work with. So it's such a diverse, bold market that we get to work in. On the negative side, again, it's a very big city. It's harder to really pick those strategic economic corridors. It's harder on the employment corridors to make sure that you get the right infrastructure in, that there's a diverse, educated population that lives within a 20, 30-minute commute of each of those corridors. So I think if I can tell what the greatest challenge is, it's making sure that we get the right infrastructure into place to support those new companies and our existing companies that are growing.
And Christine, who sets the tone for that? As someone who works for the city now and having worked for a smaller city in Chandler, how much play goes into bureaucracy? How much comes from those who've been elected to office? Does it feel like people, even if they have some disagreements, are generally on the same page as it relates to economic development?
You know, I would say with the mayor and council I have the privilege of working with, they really are interested in what's best for Phoenix. It does not have the feeling of, this is mine, that's yours, this is where that's going. It is the tone of, how do we best serve our citizens? Where is the best place that we can get the biggest bounce for our buck in funding infrastructure, in moving things forward? It is a very collaborative environment, really driven by our city manager.
Christine, I wonder, when it comes to this, and I've spoken with folks at GPEC about this in the past, when it comes to economic development, how much of that comes from nurturing the current businesses here, trying to help them get bigger and expand, and how much comes from trying to attract jobs from other states?
You know, I think that's one of the things often that cities forget is everybody likes that sex and sizzle of the headline of that new company coming into a market. But 80 to 85% of your job growth happens from your existing companies. They quietly grow and expand. We need to help them create that platform and environment where they can continue to grow. So, you know, the greatest portion of our time needs to be focusing on helping our existing companies.
I wonder also, going forward, are you seeing trends that perhaps other cities have done, other large cities, perhaps even other smaller cities, creative ideas that were at Chandler you think you'd like to see Phoenix adopt?
You know, I think one of the greatest focuses that some of the larger cities that have really revolutionized themselves or really taken it to the next level in the creative economy is focusing on entrepreneurship, focusing on innovation, growing your own companies, creating a place where that knowledge workforce wants to live and grow. You know, the millennial workforce isn't interested in a large house with a large lot and a subdivision and a pool. They want to live connected, on light rail, walkable and local. And I think the cities that are seeing the greatest success are the ones who are paying a lot of attention to their higher education partnerships, on their entrepreneur movements, creating the collaborative spaces for makers and creators and startups and tinkerers, and elevating kind of that platform. There's so much that burbles under the surface that connects the community with those strong entrepreneurial startups. You know, you look at some of the biggest companies in the world, and they all at one point in time were startups. And I think as we look at taking things forward, you look at the Austin, Seattle, San Francisco, Denver, those are the companies that are really elevating their game and creating the vibrant urban core where the entrepreneurial workforce wants to grow and innovate.
Christine, finally, as it relates to economic development, is it okay for us to be in a hurry, or would you preach patience?
you know, I really would preach patience. It's so quick and so easy in economic development to make a mistake. There's a hurry, and it's kind of a combination of the two, because there's a hurry to bring good quality jobs into a market. If you can bring a good quality job that supports someone, supports their family, puts a roof over their head, the rest of it all comes into play. It comes into play in property taxes and ways to fund parks and streets and the entire economy and social ecosystem that exists. So you do want to hurry in making sure that you create good quality jobs, but a city only has one chance to make a mistake. And it really is a thoughtful planning of where those economic corridors are going to be and what are the right companies and what's the right model to bring those companies into a market.
Christine McKay is Phoenix's Director of Community and Economic Development. Christine, thanks for squeezing us in.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On Monday afternoon in Palo Alto, California, ASU's women's basketball program accomplished something it hadn't in more than 30 years. It won on Stanford's home court. Stanford's been a perennial national contender, but ASU seems poised to get in on that conversation this season. With me to talk about that is head coach Charlie Turner Thorne, who's been in the position since 1996. Coach, how are you?
Hi, Steve. I'm great. Thank you.
You've had a really successful run at ASU, but what explains the success of this year's team?
Well, you know, that's sometimes you don't really know. I think it's been, you know, it's always a process and just the development maturity of a team. And even though we only have one senior, Steve, that plays, we do have a team that has a lot of experience. And it's a special group. It's hard to put, you know, a finger on. It's their character of this team, the maturity of this team, a lot of toughness. You know, that carries us through games like the victory at Maples, a lot of unselfishness. So at this point in the season, because we still have a lot of season left,
sure.
You know, they've just been a joy to coach. They have an amazing teachable spirit. They want to get better every day. They have all the ingredients of a championship caliber team, a team that, you know, is going to have a great journey.
Now, you played at Stanford, and I wonder if you could describe for us, if you could, how difficult it is for a road team to play at Maples Pavilion.
Well, yes, and I'm very old, so, you know, back in the Stone Age, it was as difficult. But, you know, it's gradually, they've been in six of the last seven Final Fours. You alluded to their you know, their national dominance. And I'm not the only coach in our conference that has a very dismal record at Maples. It's pretty much across the board. Nobody has won there very much at all. You know, they've owned their home floor for decades. And, you know, they just have a great fan base. You know, the Bay Area really appreciates women's basketball. And obviously Tara is an Olympic Hall of Fame coach and done a great job of building that culture and that program. And so it's loud, it's frenzied, and you've got a tough, you know, you come in there against a team that's tough, right? It's, you know, Final Four seasoned, and so obviously that made our recent success, you know, that much made me that much more proud, you know, that our team was able to accomplish that.
You know, brief sidebar, to show how old we both are, I was actually a student calling games at Santa Clara when you were an assistant there. So I remember that many years ago.
Wow.
So,
small world.
How about that?
Yeah. That's fun. Yeah. We had I had a great time at Santa Clara. We won three WCC conference championships there, and working with Karen Horstmeyer, and that was a really, really fun teaching training ground for me as a young coach.
Yeah, another school that embraced women's basketball, as you said, the Bay Area there as well. You took 1 year off from head coaching duties, and I wonder, did that renew your coaching spark? Have you changed as a coach since before that year off?
Well, yeah, you know, it's took a little 9 month sabbatical, 8.5, I guess, if we want to be really technical. And it was a great opportunity for me to step back. I hope that I'm always growing as a coach. I mean, I think, you know, no matter what, but that specific opportunity that Arizona State gave me and my administration was unbelievable, you know, because Well, people don't know. Coaching is kind of an unhealthy, crazy profession. You work every day. I mean, every day. We don't really ever take days off. A little bit in the off season, you know, if there's a little bit of quiet time in recruiting, you know, maybe we'll have a few days off for sure, you know, week or so vacation. But it just never ends. And our players really, you know, they don't go home that much, and we recruit all the time. So, you know, to be able to step back and just really evaluate, you know, how I want to grow as a coach and take a breath. You know, I do. I have three boys at home, and I was a little, you know, not living, you know, kind of what I preach with our team, which is balance you know, with basketball and school and their personal lives and stuff. So, and it did allow me to, I think, strengthen our program in different ways just by getting to step back and evaluate it. So it was wonderful for me. From a personal standpoint, and I did think we might take a quick step back, but in the long run, our program would be better for it. And I feel like that's kind of playing itself out right now.
Coach, I don't want to push this too much because no one would ever, I'm sure you wouldn't use this as an excuse, but I do wonder about the complications of, we always talk about the stereotype of whether women can have it all and that kind of thing. And you're very successful at your profession and you're a mom and you talked about balance. I mean, do you think that's more challenging than the expectations might be for a male coach?
Well, they don't have to have the actual babies, so that, you know, that part in nursing during the season, all that good stuff. But, I've spoke about balance and stuff, and I don't know that I have the secret, Steve. You know, I think life is trade-offs. You know, it is. I don't know if anybody ever has it all. You know, I mean, I think that's, for me, I do because it's a state of mind. I feel so blessed, you know, to have a great job, to work with amazing people, to have a, you know, beautiful, healthy family. I mean, you know, do I miss out on things? Do I mess up? Do I wish I was a better mom, wife, coach at times? Absolutely. You know, is there not enough time in the day sometimes? Absolutely. So, I think life is trade-offs and you do the best you can. I think you get really good at prioritizing. when, you know, you're, I guess, in a position like mine, which a lot of people are, I think for everything in life is relationships, right, Steve? So you just do the best you can day by day with relationships in your life, and then, you know, you feel good about things, so.
Charlie Turner-Thorne is head coach of the 17-1 Arizona State women's basketball team. Their next game is Friday morning at 11 against Oregon in Tempe, and we both survived lovely Santa Clara University. Coach, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you very much for listening to today's program. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help. If you'd like to hear any of our segments today again, you missed them, or you want to hear a previous program, just go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org.